Hey, it's Mignon. Today's show is the second in a series of interviews called Grammar Girl Conversations that I'm doing with my favorite people, authors, dictionary editors, medievalists, and more. Today, linguist Anne Curzan tells us why Benjamin Franklin didn't like the word colonize, how, as a member of the American Heritage Dictionary Usage Panel, she decided whether to accept that funner and funnest should be acceptable or not, and how having a laser focus on language hilariously accidentally led her to asking her students an inappropriate question. Enjoy the show. Grammar Girl here. I'm Mignon Fogarty, and I'm so excited because today I have Anne Curzan as a guest. Anne is a historian of the English language, an English professor at the University of Michigan, a language radio show host, a frequent public speaker on grammar peeves, a copy editor, and most important for us today, the author of Says Who, a kinder, funner usage guide for everyone who cares about language. Thanks so much for being here, Anne.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Yes, you're welcome. And as I was reading the subtitle of your book, it suddenly hit me that we absolutely have to talk about the word funner first, because it's in the title of your book.
And I'm going to start by asking how you feel about the word funner.
Oh, interesting. Well, we've talked about fun, funner, and funnest before on the show. I call it the fun continuum. Mm-hmm. But you say in your book that for some reason funnest feels more acceptable than funner, and I agree.
I have learned that from undergraduates over the years that their negative response is less strong to funnest than it is to funner. Let's talk about what's happening here in general. The word fun was a noun for much of its life. So if someone said that party was fun, it was like saying that party was chaos. One can also imagine that kids hearing adults say that party was fun could easily interpret fun as an adjective in that spot. That party was boring, that party was great, that party was fun. And interpret it as an adjective, they did. Interestingly, for much of the 20th century, it was controversial whether fun should even be allowed to be an adjective. I think for most of us now, that seems uncontroversial to be able to say that party was very fun, which mm-hmm. shows it's an adjective. Now, what kids do once it's an adjective is try to make it behave like other one-syllable adjectives. Tall, taller, tallest, wide, wider, widest, fun. We can see where this is going. Funner, funnest. And they'll do that until they get corrected by some adult authority figure who says, oh, no, 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 it's more fun, most fun, at which point that gets stored as an exception. But particularly in advertising, you're seeing funnest. There was an iPod commercial, the funnest iPod ever. And I think that's partly how funnest is sneaking in. And my guess is that funnest will sneak in first and funner will come in on its coattails. And it's interesting to me, people will say, oh, I just hate the way that funner sounds, to which I ask, how do you feel about the word runner? And they're like, oh, runner's fine. And I say, well, they rhyme, of course. We've just been trained to feel like there's something bad about funner or that it sounds wrong. Now, why did I put it in the title? I think both to be playful and to suggest that the book is a little bit irreverent. And I know that if I put a peeve in the title, there's a good chance that some folks will probably pick it up to see what's going on here, that I have a usage guide that has funner in the title.
So you're using the same marketing trick that Apple used with the funnest iPod ever.
Exactly.
Well, I think it's probably good practice to take marketing tips from Apple. They've done pretty well. So one of the things that intrigues me about your background is that you were on the American Heritage Dictionary Usage Panel. And I've been kind of not obsessed, but I'm intrigued by the usage panel. I think it's such an interesting panel. And we had Steve Kleinedler on a few months ago, and he was the person at the dictionary who managed the panel. And you were on it. And I would love to hear what it was like from your perspective as someone who was answering all those usage questions.
It was such an interesting experience to be on that panel. I'm glad I was able to do that. I was asked to join in 2005, and I was one of about 12 linguists on the panel, and the panel's over 200. I recognized when I agreed to serve on it that I was serving a particular role as someone with training as a linguist who might come at these questions slightly differently. It started as a paper survey, but I'll talk about it once it went online. We would receive this link to a set of questions, 30 or 40 questions, and these would be pronunciations and word meanings, grammatical issues, and you would get a set of sentences, and then there were four choices: completely unacceptable, somewhat acceptable, completely acceptable. Sometimes students will ask me, well, acceptable where? Mm-hmm. I'd say that's a really fair question. We didn't get a lot of guidance other than more formal settings, but that could be spoken, that could be written. And of course, you had to answer the question to get to the next page in the online survey. So you couldn't just say, oh, I don't want to answer this question. You had to answer it in order to keep going on the survey.
Oh, that's so interesting, because on paper, you could have just skipped it.
So you had to keep going. You could put in comments, and sometimes I would put in comments. I often thought about my fellow panelists as I would fill it out and think, how are they thinking about this decision? And when I would talk with Steve Kleinadler or others at American Heritage, they would say, we have this sense that some people just fill it out over coffee, however they're feeling about things, and some people look at data. And I was one of the data people. I also have the good fortune of teaching at the University of Michigan. So I could go to undergraduates in my courses and say, okay, how does this sound to you? Is this a pronunciation that's familiar to you? I would also use these big online databases. So when the question was, for example, is it acceptable to say or write equally as important? Because in theory, you don't need the equally there. I would go look in the database. And of course, you can find equally as important all over edited prose. And so I would say it's acceptable. You can find it. It's already there.
That's fascinating. That was kind of what I was wondering, because, you know, you are both a linguist and you've done copy editing. And I think in a lot of ways, the answer of whether something's acceptable is really different depending on which context you're working in at the time. You know, if I'm copy editing, I'm flagging something for a writer to consider. Do you want to put this in? Because maybe it'll be perceived as an error. But, you know, as a linguist, as sort of a wordy, which we'll get to in a sec, you know, I feel like language change is fascinating, and I might be more inclined to say something is acceptable if I were thinking sort of on the, I'm not a linguist, but on the linguist side sort of my brain that's developed over the years. So, but you went to data and your students and
I did. And that's part of how I thought about my role on the usage panel, which is to think about the fact that I could influence the gatekeepers. As you say, there's this sense of you might get judged for this in writing. And one of the places people will go is usage guides or the usage notes in an American Heritage Dictionary to see, is there something wrong with this? Should I correct it? Including copy editors. And the only way we're going to change that is if people on the usage panel are indicating more acceptance. And so I used my descriptive training to say we could open the gates wider, that you could have more variation in the language. You could have both as important and equally as important. It's fine to let in finalize as a verb, as well as implement and even funner and funnest, because that was on the usage panel survey. And I thought, you're never going to see changes in the gatekeeping unless those of us who are in these positions signal that the gates could be open wider and we would be fine.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's a huge responsibility to be on the panel that's making those. Because even though, you know, as Steve said, it's only a couple hundred people and it's a point in time. But when you look at that number, when you see, you know, 80% of people said this was fully acceptable or 20%, I don't know, there's something about the way our brains process numbers that you can't help but feel it's sort of set in stone and forget about the fact that it's only a relatively small number of people. So
I think that's such an important point. And I think people also forget to ask, wait a minute, who is this usage panel? Do I need to believe this usage panel? That they see 70% of the usage panel rejects this sentence and they nod and say, oh, yes, then it's clearly wrong. If you look in the preface to the dictionary, you will see, if you're in a print dictionary, you will see a note that says the usage panel should not be taken as the final authority on language. It might be a useful reference point. And that's what I think it can be, is it's one reference point for knowing how a relatively conservative group of over 200 people feel about usage. And then you can use that as you're making decisions as a speaker and writer.
Right. And I mean, that's the title of your book, Says Who?
Exactly.
On all these things, Says Who? Well, I have another question for you that's a little philosophical before we get into the fascinating tidbits from your book, because you did a TED Talk about what is a word, a very popular TED Talk. And my husband and I debate this, you know, over dinner. We disagree about what is a word. And so he's not here to defend himself. So I'm just going to say he's wrong. But he insists that, you know, one of the things he holds to is that if a word hasn't been used for a couple hundred years, we shouldn't call it a word anymore. And because nobody uses it, nobody knows what it means, how can you call it a word if you see it and it looks like gibberish to you? So I'd love to get into the philosophical idea of what makes something a word.
I'm fascinated by this question as well. And I get it on a regular basis, given what I do, where someone will pick a word that is relatively new to them and say, but Anne, is that a real word? And so I've thought a lot about what do people mean by that question? And a lot of times I think what they mean is, could I find that in a standard dictionary? Now, what they'll say is, could I find it in the dictionary? And I have also thought a lot about that phrase, the dictionary, because of course there are lots and lots of dictionaries and they have different approaches and different philosophies. They were published at different dates. They're British, they're American, they're from other countries. So lots of stuff packed into that phrase, the dictionary. A word is a real word if it has a shared meaning within a community. If I can use the word to other people in my community, whether that's a little specialized community or a broader community, and other people know what I mean, then that string of sounds is functioning as a word. I love the question of whether archaic words are still words. I would make the argument that they are because they have a preserved life in literature or in documents. There are, of course, many old words that have just died because they weren't in the written record, and therefore we don't now know that they existed. So they're no longer a word, because if you uttered them, you would have no way to know what that meant. The words that are preserved in writing, I would say, are still real words because they're meaningful to people who read that literature, who study that literature. They have a context in which they live. But this is where dictionary editors are doing that hard work of labeling, that this word is a real word, but it's obsolete or it's archaic, to suggest that it might still be useful to have it in a dictionary because someone might need to find it, but it's not functioning like the words that we use every day.
Thank you. Well, I think this is a good time to take a quick break for our sponsors. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the fascinating tidbits from Anne's book, Says Who. And we're back with Anne Curzan, author of Says Who. And the book is just filled with interesting anecdotes, you know, things that I didn't know about language, even though I've been doing this for many, many years. So one anecdote that just blew my mind is that people lamented the loss of the double negative in English. So Anne, please tell us more about that.
I love this quote because it shakes people up in the way they think about judgments about what is correct and incorrect English. And one of my points in the book is that these judgments change over time. The concept of good English or correct English or standard English is not stable. If you look at the history of English, double negation or multiple negation was widespread in English. Old English, you find double and multiple negation. Chaucer's era, it's still there. Into the Renaissance. And then it so happens that the variety of English that gets standardized and becomes the standard variety in Britain moves to single negation. But many varieties of English retain double negation and have double negation to this day. It is now often seen as illogical or wrong, but it is important to remember that, of course, all varieties had it. And in the late 19th century, there is this quote of someone, Fitzedward Hall, who is quoting the London Review and talking about how terrible it is that we've lost double negation. And he looks back to the King James Bible, 1611, and says, that is the high point. And I always love it. People look back to some moment, Jane Austen, Charles Dickens, the King James Bible, Chaucer. That was when English was really good, and it has all been downhill since then. So he says 1611 was the high point, and then goes on, the double negative has been abandoned to the great injury of strength of expression.
It's just, I'm sure many people in the audience are just saying, what? How can that be?
I know, but of course, double negation can be a wonderful construction. It is a part of many people's grammar. And I love the fact that some people will try to make the argument that it is illogical because in math, two negatives cancel each other out, which I find to be a fascinating argument for a couple of reasons. One is that language is not math. Second, even if we were to do math, if you multiply two negatives in math, it is true that you get a positive. But if you add two negatives, you get a bigger negative.
You know, as not a math person, I probably never would have thought of that.
So it's these kinds of things of trying to help people rethink some of the beliefs that we have inherited. And I inherited them as well. My mother was a very prescriptive person. She had been trained in her life in terms of proper or correct grammar. She edited all my papers in high school. She was a copy editor herself. And we went to the grocery store and she'd point out the sign that said 10 items or less and make sure that her daughters knew that that sign was grammatically incorrect. So I learned all of this as I was growing up. And it wasn't until I started studying linguistics in college that I realized there was another way to think about these issues. And I started to learn about how the English language has changed over time and how attitudes about what's right and wrong have also changed over time.
Yeah, I love using examples of words that people objected to in the past because words that seem so normal to us. And you had some examples that I had not heard before. So you want to go through some of those that are from your book?
Oh, I'd be delighted because I also find these hilarious and really useful because I think they can help us get some perspective on whatever peeve is bothering us at this moment. Richard Grant White, who was a grammarian in the late 19th century, is one of my favorites. And he did not like the verb donate. He felt that this was utterly abominable. And he thought it was abominable because it had been backformed from the noun donation, which is, of course, true. You had donation first, and then donate was created, backformed out of donation. But now we look at his complaint and we think, donate is abominable? Really?
They use such strong language in their objection.
Very strong language. And abominable actually is a word that comes up quite often. Ben Franklin gave up the verb colonize as bad. And over time, I have to say, I-Z-E words have not fared well. Colonize, finalize was seen as jargon in the 1960s. Now people don't like incentivize. Those poor I-Z-E verbs really struggle. Ben Franklin also did not like new verbs such as notice or advocate, which had been created from the nouns, and they were relatively new in his era. And then another favorite from Richard Grant White. This is actually a new use of the verb leave. And here he says, this verb is very commonly ill-used by being left without an object. Thus, Jones left this morning. I shall leave this evening. Left what shall leave what? Not the morning or the evening, but how? But home, town, or country. When this verb is used, the mention of the place referred to is absolutely necessary.
It would never occur to me that anyone would ever object to that. It's just, it seems hilarious today. And I always imagine people 200 years from now looking at, you know, how we object to, I don't know, adulting or conversate or something like that and saying, how ridiculous those people were in the 2020s, you know?
Exactly. And when I think about, there you have Richard Grant White worried about leave, which had always been used with an object, being used without an object. And just recently, someone complained to me about how jargony it is to say to progress a project or to grow a business. And I thought, you're going to lose.
Right. Yeah. One I heard about recently that surprised me was to calendar something, to put it on the calendar. And yeah, I mean, but it's, you know, people say it because it's useful.
Absolutely. Yeah. I can use that intransitively as well, that we're going to, it's time for us to calendar.
Oh, I have not heard that.
Which is like, we need to coordinate our calendar. So my partner and I will calendar.
Here's the thing. I hate that, but I also recognize that language changes, and if it's useful to people, it will probably win.
Well, and I think that that gets to that even you and I have a little inner Gramando in our head that is going to hear some of these things and not be happy about it.
Right. I think it's important to acknowledge that there are things that you don't like, but that doesn't make them wrong or not useful or not part of the way language is going. It can be both. You know, you don't have to use it yourself. And again, like if you're copy editing, you know, it's maybe something that you should flag or, you know, for the writer to make their own decision. And there I am using the singular they, which we all do all the time and is fine. So
that's right. And I love the way you said that right there of flag this so the writer can make their own decision. And that's something that I'm trying to reinforce in this book, which is that the more information we have about how language works, about how different usage guides have handled an issue, we can make more informed choices as speakers and as writers, not saying this is right and this is wrong, but here are attitudes about this. Now you can decide how you want to navigate your way through this. I also love the way you talked about your inner Gramando of, you know, you can feel it and then you decide, what am I going to do with this feeling that right. I have? I just caught myself recently, a colleague of mine at the business school uses the verb double click as his transition between slides. So if there are, for example, three things in a list, he will say, okay, and then let's double click on the first one. Mm-hmm. And that will be the transition to the next slide where we're going to dive into or dig into whatever was on the first bullet point. And I sat there going, this is such business school jargon. I can't believe that he's using double click this way. And I don't often let my inner Gramando out of my head. Usually we just have conversations in my head. But I came home and I was telling my partner, I can't believe the way double click is being used. And he said, I actually think it's quite clever. And my inner Gramando just stop talking right there. Because of course it is actually rather delightful.
You just took a deep breath. Look at it with a new perspective. Well, I'm really envious of you in your position as a professor. It's been 7 years since I've worked with students. And, you know, it's such a wonderful opportunity to sort of be on top of what's changing with language. And you mentioned that amongst your students are using amongst more often. And I had just started noticing that, but I'm still hearing it from people. Do you feel like it's increasing even more? And if so, why? It sounds so formal or British. Why are students doing this?
I can't tell yet if it's on the increase or if it's just there as a variant. It could be a couple of things. One is, as writers, particularly I teach at a university, students are trying on and experimenting with more formal kinds of writing because that's what they're being asked to do. So they're experimenting with different kinds of conjunctive adverbs and things that are much more characteristic of formal writing than they are of speech. Moreover, nevertheless, these are not words that we tend to use in our everyday conversations. And I think that amongst feels more formal to students, and so it may find its way into more formal writing as the way that however is a more formal way of saying but, amongst is a more formal way of saying among. There also may be something playful happening here, and this is something I'd want to watch. As you may know, there has been some playfulness around whomst.
Yes, whomst.
And so that ST at the end has a kind of slangy irreverence to it. And I can't tell if that is happening or might happen with amongst.
That's great. No, I've had whomst on my list of possible topics for about a year. It's great. I have to figure out what's going on there. And I've seen whomstove, like whomst apostrophe VE.
And whomst ever.
Oh, I haven't seen that yet. Oh my gosh. Well, you know, thinking about change, you know, you do a radio program. Do you hear, has there been a change in the types of questions you get in the last, say, 5 years or so? Are there any trends that you have your finger on that we should know about?
I don't. One of the things I love about the radio show is that people write in with words that I have not thought a lot about. Now, occasionally this could be because there's a change happening in the language. For example, recently I started to get questions about a training or trainings.
Hmm.
Now, this had not really been on my radar because I will say I go to trainings all the time and I hadn't thought about it. But it is being seen as jargony.
Hmm.
It is also being seen as new.
Huh.
Of course, I went to the Oxford English Dictionary, and it turns out that training as a singular is hundreds of years old. Looks like it probably goes back to military trainings, and you could have a military training, but pretty quickly it generalized to any kind of training. That said, if you go to Google Books, to the Ngram viewer, and you look at trends, you see that it has radically increased. That singular use of training has dramatically increased over the last 20 years. And that's why people are noticing it, is that suddenly it's in the water, it's in the air, we're seeing it written down, we're hearing it, and people are suddenly saying, even though it's been around for hundreds of years, oh, I don't like that. It must be new, and it must be wrong.
It's so funny. I feel like I've heard that my whole life. But yeah, when things increase, more people notice, or it can become maybe a feeling of being overused. So that could be too.
I think that's right. And people's reaction to overuse sometimes is it's being overused, but sometimes it is, this is wrong. It's that little inner Gramando that notices a new thing and has this negative reaction. And then sometimes that comes out of our mouth as a correction, as opposed to, I'm having some kind of personal reaction to this term, which I probably will get over. For a long time, I have not liked the adjective impactful. I have no good reason for this. It's perfectly well-formed, meaningful, hopeful, impactful. And I can feel myself close to using it. I start sentences saying, this change is going to be very, and I realize I'm headed straight for it. And then I have to take a right or a left turn and say, it's very significant. But what I want to say is impactful, and it's probably 6 more months and I'll get over it.
Yeah. Well, the other section that I really loved in the book says who, was the section on irregular verbs, because I've talked about sneaked and snuck, you know, many times in the past, but you had some examples that I just hadn't thought of before. And, you know, the thing that's interesting about snuck is that the verb is going from regular to irregular, which isn't the like typical way you think of verbs changing, but it's actually not the only one. So if you could talk about that and some of those examples to finish up today, that would be fantastic.
Of course. And I think snuck is a great example because it's happening all around us. And it's right now quite distinctively American English that British speakers often will see snuck as quite an American English feature. As a historian of the language, people will sometimes ask me, is English getting more regular over time? And my answer is yes, except where it's not. And it's the fun perspective of being someone who studies the whole history of the English language. We have verbs that used to be irregular that become regular over time. So help, the past tense was holp, and now it's helped. So it picks up that ed and becomes a regular verb. But the verb dig, the past tense used to be digged. And in fact, you can find digged in the King James Bible. But now the past tense is dug. Yeah. And the verb dive, you actually can find two past tenses right now. For many speakers, the past tense is dove, but for some speakers, the past tense is dived. And dived is actually the older form. Dove is the newer form. There we can probably guess at the analogy, drive, drove, dive, dove. But these things happen in the language. And I think a verb to watch is drag.
Mm.
And right. I will tell a story on myself, which is one of the funniest stories of my teaching career, which is it happened on the first day of class. I was talking with students about sneak and snuck because I also think it's a great example. And the graduate student assistant in the class said, you know, the other day I heard someone use drug as the past tense of drag, at which point I turned to this entire class of undergraduates and I say, so how many of you are drug users? And as soon as it comes out of my mouth, I say, oh, no, no, no. Don't tell me. Don't tell me. I don't want to know.
I laughed out loud when I read that in the book. Actually, I actually literally laughed out loud.
Very nice use of literally.
Thank you for emphasis, but also accurate. Well, what fun it must be to take your classes at the University of Michigan. And, you know, it was, I'm sure it's as much fun as reading your book, Says Who, A Kinder, Funner Usage Guide for Everyone Who Cares About Words. Thank you so much. Where can people find you if they want to, you know, follow you online or learn more about you?
Sure. Well, the podcast that you mentioned is That's What They Say. They can find that anywhere where they find their podcasts. And the new book they can find at any bookstore or online retailer. And you can follow me on Instagram or my website, annkurzan.com.
Are you Ann Kurzan at Instagram too?
Yes.
That's Ann with an E.
It's Ann with an E.
Wonderful. Well, thanks again for being here, Ann with an E. I've loved our conversation.
Thank you for a wonderful and fun conversation.
I hope you all enjoyed my conversation with Ann Kurzan. I'll be back Tuesday with our regular episode, and make sure to check your feed again Thursday for our next installment of Grammar Girl Conversations, when I'll be talking with Hannah Vaideen about weird medieval words for animals. You really want to hear why medieval people thought whales were evil. That's all. Thanks for listening.